Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. We are a community of expert technologists, professionals, and faith leaders bringing the ancient wisdom of the world's major religions to the ethics of artificial intelligence. Join us on this new journey and welcome to the conversation.
A sustainable data economy would be one that doesn't just train the model, but that creates a whole feedback loop throughout the entire system to make it work better. That, to me, is what you could call symbiogenesis, you know, the emergence of relationality between the machines and people, rather than artificial superintelligence.
My name is Pablo Andrés Ruzalmones, and I will be your podcast host. Today's episode is from an event in March 2026. We interviewed renowned author Glenn Vale about plurality and how we can actually make sure that artificial intelligence is embedded within the communities of our time. How can we actually bring together communities and technology? How can we actually embed religion and make sure that we take into consideration the religious perspectives into artificial intelligence models? These and many other topics we talked about with Glenn. Listen now to our conversation.
Thank you so much, Glenn, for being here today with us. Glenn is founder and research lead at Microsoft Research Plural Technology Laboratory, co-founder and chair of the Plurality Institute, co-founder and chair of Radical Change Foundation, and co-founder of the Faith, Family, and Technology Network. He co-authored the influential book Radical Markets, the widely read paper Decentralized Society, and the first democratically self-governed and fully open source book, Plurality. Glenn graduated as valedictorian from Princeton in 2007 and earned his PhD in economics from Princeton in 2008. Glenn, thank you so much for being here. It truly is an honor to have you here with us today. Also great to know that you're coming from Mexico. So that's also wonderful to know that you've been here very recently.
Yeah, I thought that was a fun point of connection and a fun coincidence. So such an honor to be with you, Pablo. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I'm really looking forward to connecting with everyone.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Glenn. And, you know, just as I was mentioning before we started, I've been reading some of your work, and I think it's fascinating in so many ways. I wanted to ask you first and foremost, perhaps to give a bit of context here for everyone, a double-sided question. The first is, what exactly is plurality for those of you who perhaps are not as familiar with your work on that matter? And why are you interested in the intersection between technology and faith?
Great. So I'm going to give an answer to that that I think I've never quite given before. I'm very delighted to have read an article just today that came from Brian Grimm, who is a friend of this network. I think many of you have probably interacted with him. He works on religious liberty and business issues. And he referred to this article by Noreen Herzfeld, which I thought was really wonderful. I think it's called Made in Our Image or something like that, about sort of how people approach artificial intelligence given their conceptions of human anthropology. And she distinguishes between sort of one conception based on something we possess, like reason or intelligence. And that has a big influence on the artificial intelligence world, obviously. A second based on things we can do, like go to the moon or cure diseases, which also has quite an influence in the technology world. And the third perspective, which is much less common in that world, is based on relationality. This does, in fact, show up in some tech discourse. If you read someone like Yuval Noah Harari, and many of the, you know, actual accounts based on neuroscience and anthropology, but it doesn't show as much up in the way that technology tends to be conceived, which is we're trying to replicate this ability to do things rather than this ability to connect and relate to each other. And even more than relationality, I would say that humans are the cultural communal animals, because relationality sounds dyadic. But I really think humans are not, it's not about dyads, it's about the ability to form shared attention. When children are very young, the latest, you know, child developmental psychology shows the reason that they're interested in attention is not actually attention on them in sort of a selfish way. It has to do with joint attention with the parent. They want to be attending to the same object because they're waiting for language acquisition. They're waiting to be able to give a name to that thing that they can then share and use to communicate with someone else. And so I think one of our most fundamental capacities and needs as humans is the ability to form cultures, meaning, connection, relationality, shared ideation. And there are many forms, and essentially plurality, I would say, is what would technology look like if it was squarely centered on that conception of the human? If it thought about relationships and collectivity and complexity, how would we approach technology in that way? So here's the book. You know, we technically define it as technology for collaborative diversity, for collaboration across social differences, which to me, you know, is exactly that communal relational notion of what technology is about. And why does that get me interested in religion? Ultimately, because if you ask, what are the oldest, deepest, and most important forms of shared meaning that humans have, it's religion. So of course, we can talk about all kinds of other forms of culture, but we're kind of missing, you know, it's like talking about sports and never mentioning soccer. So religion is the prototypical example of that shared meaning making that humans have. And many other forms of, you know, culture are incredibly important, but I think being concrete is incredibly valuable. And religion is, I think, the, you know, sharpest manifestation of that, and is one that's been excluded from the technology world for so long. And so if you want to sort of get to the heart of the tension between this sort of culturally grounded view and this more utilitarian view or individualistic view of human capacities, I think religion really cuts to the core of that.
Thank you so much, Glenn. You did give a lot of information and good insights on this answer. I had the privilege of interviewing Noreen. She was the second person I interviewed here, Noreen Hirschfeld, in the IMFA salons. And so this concept that you're saying right now about relationality and our relationship to AI and all that was something that we went deep in that conversation. And I'm glad that you bring it to this conversation again. Now, I wanted to ask you about the ability to form cultures, you know, and this shared ideation that you just mentioned, and also a bit more about plurality and how technology would look with this collective collaboration. In your book and in other of your publications and some of your work, you mentioned the case of Taiwan, for example, right? And a bit of how that started to move forward. So perhaps for people to visualize it more than just a concept, how do you think it actually looks like? How would a technology that's centered around these principles actually looks like?
Well, let me give an illustration from AI, because of course this group is based around AI. So the basic unit of interaction is in an AI chatbot experience is the sort of universalistic or somehow almost godlike AI interacting with the individual human who's reading it. There is no sense of the communities in which that person participates. It creates a personalized or universalized experience. It doesn't tend towards creating an audience that is co-experiencing things together. Let me give you an alternative to that. Imagine that the model knew or intuited or asked you about the communities that you're a part of, and then responded to most of your queries in a way that was grounded in those communities. So if you are a Catholic Mexican technologist, it might respond to you to a question about abortion, say, by telling you about the Catholic perspective on abortion, and then saying, but this view is controversial in Mexico, and it's very unpopular within the tech industry. Would you like to hear what the perspectives in those other areas are? And then you would explore things not from a globalized perspective or from a sycophantic personal perspective, but from one that made you aware of the communities that you're a part of, and that never gave you a sense that the thing you were interacting with was another being or some abstracted intelligence, but instead was a repository or window onto the communities that you're a part of. So, I mean, this is not the essence of plurality. This is just one application of the plurality ideas, but just to make it concrete and connected to the AI space.
Thank you so much, Glenn. Yeah, now that you mentioned this window to different communities, I have a friend in the US who normally tells me that technology has this power to bring together people that are very, very far away from each other, but sometimes pushes you away from the people who are right next to you. And precisely referring to that community feeling, right? I mean, you just mentioned it in the case of AI and chatbots, but I think that the way he normally applies it is in a broader way, and to some degree, it makes sense about what's happening.
And by the way, I have no problem with connecting people to people who are far away from each other.
No, I think it's wonderful.
if you forget who you are in the process, and you come to conceptualize yourself as just an abstracted individual or an abstracted, you know, intelligence, then you've lost precisely what it is valuable that allows you to connect to people who are further away, which is your particularity.
Yeah, no, of course. And I think that connecting people who are far away from you, it's one of the greatest things that we've ever had throughout, you know, history. So I was just saying it in the sense that I think that sometimes these communities that you're mentioning sometimes are not reflected in the way that technology operates. So, but no, it's, I get it. Now, another question that I have for you, Glenn, based on these principles on plurality and AI, you mentioned how materialization of AI could look like based on these principles, but how can we actually make it happen? One thing is to say, I mean, I think this is the way it should be done, but how can we actually contribute to something like that, to developing this sort of technology under these principles?
Well, you know, the great thing is that there used to be engineering challenges for doing this kind of thing. But the way that these tools are developing, the engineering challenges are really melting away. I've been working on a prototype of this sort of thing. And it used to be that, you know, you would set up a set of metrics, you would set up a set of data, you would, you know, then you would tell the model, you know, you would tune the model's parameters. The models are now so powerful that really most of what you need to do at this point to realize some interaction modality is describe in a compelling way and with some grounding in, you know, some texts, et cetera, what you want the experience to be like. And of course, you can refine it from there. But, you know, it always used to be that the hardest thing was to get that minimal viable product, you know, together and to get an experience in front of people that they could react to. And that's just become so much easier. So I think it's this incredible opportunity in time, not really for the engineers, but for the people who care about and want to shape and have a vision for where technology could go, but maybe don't have an engineering background, because now they're being set free to play out those worlds. And so what ends up mattering is that vision and the relationality, the ability of them to build coalitions and to show evidence that that's the experience that people value and that can organize people. And so I hope that is going to empower precisely that sort of cultural and relational form that I think religious communities show more than any other type of group in the world, honestly, maybe governments or similar. And so that, I think, is the great opportunity of this moment.
Yes, thank you, Glenn. And you just mentioned something about freeing people. And I have two questions on that. I find it interesting that you use the word free, you know, to kind of like free people, what we just mentioned right now, you know, and being able to form this relationality and build these coalitions and all this. It's interesting because I don't know if you will agree with this characterization, but it's just as a provocative statement. I think that many people would say that technology has, yes, to some degree freed them, but in some other cases, they've actually made it much more difficult, you know, to be free in a world in which perhaps many people feel that they are being watched, or that everything that they do is somehow stays and that data is no longer theirs. So how can you reconcile both concepts about freeing people, but at the same time having other entities, call it this way, having all the information that they have about us?
Yeah, so I, you know, when I said frees us, I didn't mean that technology in general is going to lead to more freedom. But what I did mean is that the constraints on our ability to do things from a technical level have been removed. And so then that creates enormous responsibility and opportunity for communities to actually define the boundaries within which freedom is possible. And to me, those are not those of sort of liberating the individual. They are building social structures within which people have solidarity and connection. And, you know, you speak about privacy. To me, actually, the issue is not really about privacy at the individual level. What we need instead is what, you know, in Catholic social thought, they would call subsidiarity. We need the ability to empower communities to collectively govern themselves and to replace centralized top-down technical surveillance with community self-monitoring and standards of ethics that then relate across communities and build upwards towards a, you know, broader interaction. And that's what I think, you know, has been so lost in a lot of the, you know, technological platforms recently. But I think that the sort of narrative that we used to have, that it takes all of these engineers and these engineers come from a very particular culture and so forth to build these things, that's no longer the main constraint, you know? And so instead, this is an opportunity, if they're willing to take it, for religious communities and leaders and other cultural groups to be the masters of their own directions and communities and tools that they use to connect. And so that to me is the great opportunity. It's a freedom that is not really for the individual. It's a freedom for communities to reinscribe the individual into their social relationships that give their lives meaning.
Why do you think this religious perspective has been pushed aside? You know, I mean, it's now being brought back to life by organizations like AI and Faith, but you mentioned it's like speaking of sports and never mentioning soccer, right? About having this something as deep as religion as a basis for many relationships and culture shaping societies. Why do you think that in the technology world, it has not been considered as something essential?
I think that, you know, there's a very long history in the Anglosphere, not in the rest of the world, but in the Anglosphere, especially and to a lesser extent the rest of the West, where there was sort of a conflict between religion and science and technology. Elaine Eklund and her collaborators, who also are friends of this network, I understand, have written wonderful stuff about this. There's a great book called Secularity in Science. And it's very different in Asia and in general, sort of in outside of the West, where there's a much stronger sense of collaboration and connection between science and technology on the one hand and religion on the other. And I think we have a lot to learn from those traditions. And I'm writing a book about that and how we can bring all of the wisdom of the Western religious traditions, but have a relationship to science and technology that is more learning from what they have done in the Eastern traditions. This is very related to some of, you know, sort of Ian McGilchrist's work about left and right brain, you know, divisions and so forth. But I think that that led to a world where, in practice, I grew up in Silicon Valley, and I grew up in a very relentlessly neo-atheist family that was almost like a hate environment towards religious people. And it's just amazing throughout the tech world how the one minority group that you can find that is just relentlessly marginalized and ignored by all of the discourse in the tech world is religion, even though from a global perspective, it's a majority group. So in terms of underrepresented minorities, it's really unbelievable that that is the way that religion is treated in the tech atmosphere. But again, I think it comes out of the sort of sordid history of the relationship between technology and religion in the, you know, Western and especially the Anglosphere. And it's a totally different situation in, you know, Asia, Japan, Taiwan, India, etc.
You mentioned, well, that's a perspective on the Western world, particularly the English-speaking Western world, you know, but religion and is something that's all over the world. Like, you know, that's kind of like the standard. That's the main thing. And it happens the same thing with communities. Technology, for example, and the recent, these huge AI models, for example, do actually fail to take into consideration, as you mentioned in the beginning, the different communities and the different characteristics of the very many different people that inhabit a particular area. they feel sometimes that they're pushed aside, not only in the use of that technology, but also in the way that these technologies have been developed. Even though these different peoples and these different communities have been here for thousands of years, right? Like they've literally been here forever, for a very, very long time, but somehow these technologies does not take that into consideration. Now, you also mentioned previously that communities have the opportunity to be masters of kind of like their own standards, and you mentioned this freedom to communities. How do you think that even if they're not engineers, and right now we can configure many things, but not everyone has the same access to technology, and not everyone has the same access to all these new advancements and progress that's been recently made. What do you think could be a path forward for many of these communities and countries and developing countries that perhaps feel that they've been left aside or pushed aside by the elite technology world? How do you think that they could reinforce themselves?
Well, you mentioned
themselves?
The question about data value earlier, right?
Yep.
And if we get the data economy working right, which is a complicated and very contingent thing, but if we get the data economy working right, what the models need are data that stretch them, that force them to confront very different things, that deal with domains they have not mastered yet. The complexity of human proprioception, very unusual languages, different patterns of thought. And those things are what many of the marginalized communities of the world, the people left out of what the great sociologist from Peru, Anibal Quijano, calls modernity/coloniality. That's what they have to bring. And I think there's an enormous opportunity. And of course, there's huge risks, but there's an enormous opportunity that in this new world that could be opened up by these technologies, if we push them in the right direction, that what will come to be valued is that cultural groundedness, diversity, creativity, different ways of manifesting human culture and potential. And that will actually, sort of the same way that the attention to biodiversity opened up possibilities for the tropics, the attention to cultural diversity that could come from these models could create opportunities for inclusion for many of those who have previously been left out.
And Glenn, you mentioned an if, which is a big if, which is the data economy working right. How do you envision that happening?
Well, first of all, the current equilibrium that we're in is not really good for anyone. All of the big model companies are facing tons of lawsuits. They're a maturing industry that really can't deal with that kind of risk. They're no longer in the Napster phase. They're trying to become more, stabilized. At the same time, there's growing political backlash. Senators Hawley and Blumenthal have a very strong piece of legislation working its way through the Senate around data, value. And as the economic impacts start to hit, I think there's going to be growing attention to this. Most of the large model makers and hyperscalers have now hired people or have people in leadership roles who are very sympathetic to the idea of creating that kind of sustainable data economy. And as they face, attacks from China and others stealing their models, they're going to care more about being able to make the argument for protection of those in the same way that people who create the input data are arguing for protection of their contributions. So I think that there's a moment where there could be a settlement where all these things come together and do what's actually best for the industry, honestly. Because while each individual model maker doesn't want to be the only one paying for data, everyone is going to benefit from having a diversity and well-incented people creating really creative outputs and not just a bunch of AI slop that causes the models that train on them to collapse. So this is really in everyone's interest. It's just a question of overcoming those collective action problems. And I think there's a very real possibility of doing that.
Thank you, Glenn. And yeah, you just also mentioned in this paper that I was referencing before that should we treat data as labor? Perhaps can you go a bit deeper into what a sustainable data economy might actually look like? You say that there are different factors that perhaps we could, you know, bring together. But for people who are here listening, what does a sustainable data economy actually looks like?
Well, I mean, the way I think about it is that when you train a neural network, what you do is you see, you feed data in, and then you predict the next word or whatever the relevant next token, whatever the relevant unit of prediction is. And then based on accuracy, you backpropagate a signal throughout the system that strengthens connections that are good at predicting and that weakens connections that are unhelpful in predicting. And then you get to the input nodes where the data first came in and you throw that away. So that signal just gets completely lost. But of course, the model, if you're trying to do some kind of global optimization, you shouldn't just be thinking about the in silico part of the model. The things that are feeding into the input nodes are themselves generated by other neural networks in human brains, in social systems, in ecologies. And you want to encourage those things to give information that's helpful. And you want to discourage stuff that is distracting or harmful, whether that's generated by other models, whether that's generated by people, whether it's generated by environmental sensors or ecological factors, et cetera. And so a sustainable data economy would be one that doesn't just train the model, but that creates a whole feedback loop throughout the entire system to make it work better. That, to me, is what you could call symbiogenesis, you know, the emergence of relationality between the machines and people, rather than artificial superintelligence, which is about the separation of those systems, the reduction of dependence and relationality. We've architected a system that is all based on this naive conception of human capabilities as about achieving goals rather than forming connections and relations. And if we can address that, then we can build machines that are part of the fabric of the ecology and human societies, and they'll be more optimal in the process as well.
Do you think that people, or most people, would be open to having these machines that are part of that relationality? You know, you're mentioning that we have kind of like divided this world, but is it something that's coming from the top down, or perhaps it's something that some people actually wanted to be divided in an effort to kind of, let's say, protect what is inherently human? I'm not saying I necessarily agree with that point of view. I'm just asking that I think that there might be some people out there from, you know, general society and people who might believe in those principles and saying, well, you know, let's just push this together because I don't want to have a relationship to a machine. You know, I don't want a machine to be part of that social fabric, if you call it that way. I'm a pianist, by the way, so I'm thinking of artists, for example, that we don't want technology anything to do with art. It's something that's completely ours.
Well, if you're a pianist, obviously you're not one of those people, because
I'm not.
It's a piece of technology, right? So
I am.
Technology has been around. I mean, most of the things that we think of as alternative technologies are technologies. Pianos are technologies. Books are technologies. All of these things, we are co-defined with the things we create. We make and we relate through the things that we make. And those things jointly, you know, evolve with each other. Another example of this is many people who are concerned about the climate tend to romanticize earlier periods of human development, partly because of a very genuine and reasonable concern about the climate. But I think one thing that they're importantly missing is that we literally, there's no way we would ever realize that we are harming the climate if we had stopped at the level of development that we were in the 1920s. It took the computer to make climate change visible, because there is so much statistical noise in everyone's experience of weather. And only the detailed environmental sensing compared across many different places makes it possible for us to have the self-awareness to understand the climate change problem and intervene on it. And so there's no possibility of humans relating to each other in the way that we do as humans without the employment of tools of various kinds. And there is no way for us to make that sustainable and integrated without create knowledge systems that allow us to have the awareness of the ways that we're impacting things. You know, humans swept into North America and destroyed the woolly mammoth. And they almost certainly forgot about the existence of the woolly mammoths shortly thereafter. The only way that we were able to understand the way in which we were devastating the environment and to correct for it was the further development of archaeology and natural history and so forth.
As you're saying, there seems to be this ideation or this idea that whatever came before, they paint a rosy world, you know, of what came before, as you're saying. And, you know, perhaps without realizing that without the computer, we wouldn't have been able to measure the impact on the environment and many other things. So, I mean, I agree with what you're saying in the rational argument, but my question is not so much that, but rather, how can we actually convince people of it? There is, again, this huge AI, huge backlash from many communities who are, some are worried about their jobs, and some are worried about that AI is invading, let's call it that way, the one thing that makes us human, or the things that makes us most human. So I understand the rational part of your argument, and I certainly agree with it. But my question is, how can we convey these ideas to people? Is it a matter of convincing? Is it a matter of opening the eyes? Or how can we take this to everyday people?
There's a famous expression in Taoism that to give no trust is to get no trust. Mm. And I think that in many ways, the technology world has given no trust to tradition and ancient wisdom. And so the people who are tied to that tradition and ancient wisdom are not reciprocating with trust. And of course, it's a circular relationship, but a positive feedback loop has to start with someone. Again, another Taoist expression is the journey of 1,000 miles starts beneath your feet. So if technologists can extend a hand of friendship to communities of faith and take their needs and concerns seriously, perhaps they'll find that the person on the other side does not spit in that hand. I think that that is always, you know, the best starting point for us to approach others, not from a perspective of persuasion and bringing them around, but from a perspective of listening and incorporating, and then hoping that that will build that relationship, that it enables things to go further and faster. Because if you try to accelerate without inclusion, you'll face backlash. If you accelerate through inclusion, you actually will go, you know, much further. There's a famous other expression that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I think that that is what we have to strive for in the technology world.
Yeah, certainly, certainly, Glenn. And one final question. We're talking about bringing people together in the end, perhaps through different communities. And we're talking about bringing people together through this relationality and, you know, using technology. But there seems to be very many deep differences that, again, have existed for thousands of years, you know, between different peoples and different religions, certain differences and certain things that we have been unable as human beings to bring together. So my question is, how do you think that technology can help us solve this issue? We can still see the many difficulties that arise in different parts of the world and conflicting ideas from, you know, not necessarily just from religion, but from many different perspectives too. How do you think that technology can help us bridge those gaps?
Analogy I usually give in the idea of plurality is that if you think about thermodynamics, like what underlies energy, what we call energy, it's actually low entropy. It's things being separated and differentiated. And when those things get mixed, often you get an explosion. So, you know, we used to see fire erupting from the ground and we tried to put it out. But then we learned to drill for oil and to build machines that could use that to do productive things, right? And I think that when we see social conflict erupting, our reaction should not be, oh no, we need to suppress that. It should be, how do we harness this productively? Because that's an incredible opportunity. You know, if you just think about Twitter, everyone complains about Twitter, but think about how much time people spend having flame wars on Twitter. I don't think we should view that as a negative. We should view that as what an opportunity. That's all this civic energy that people have. If we could just channel that think about how much more productive politics in the country we have. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, it's flames, but you should build the engine that harnesses that potential energy towards productive, you know, civic improvement, rather than trying to put it out. That's what a lot of the technology that I've been involved in, a lot of things that Audrey Tong has done, she's my collaborator and the one who gave me my Chinese name, has done. There's a wonderful movie about her life, which is a very spiritual movie as well, called Good Enough Ancestor. It's available free online.
Thank you. Thank you so, so much, Glenn. It's been a true pleasure and an honor to have you here and sharing so very many different perspectives on things, you know, coming both from technology, from religion, from science, from all these, from, you know, just a sociology perspective, if you will, as well. So thank you so, so much for being here with us. It's truly been an honor to host you, and we hope to hearing a lot more from you very soon.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more recordings and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on our social media as well. We're on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us today.